have got an international audience, so we need to be mindful of trying to encompass a range of contexts, in, both in presentations and in questions and answers. The last presentation, declared up front was UK centric, and then proceeded to give a message which was completely international, and which I'm sure all of our international colleagues would be able to take away with them. So let's hope we can maintain that sort of inclusion. So it's over to Sarah to tell us about catalysts and triggers.
Yes.
In a Welsh context.
Indeed, in a Welsh context. Yeah. Thank you very much. And yes, indeed, I will endeavour to be as inclusive as possible, but I apologise in advance. I tend to be a little bit of a fast talker, so if I do start rattling on, please slow me down and please do stop me. Obviously, I'm very mindful of the time this morning. So, catalysts and triggers in lifelong learning, an exploration of engagement in the South Wales Valley area of the UK. My name is Sarah Graves. I'm a second year PhD student at the University of Glamorgan in South Wales, just north of Cardiff in Tree Forest. And my PhD is supervised by Professor Danny Saunders and Dr. Rob Payne, and full time with them are here at the FACE conference this year. So, what I'd like to cover in the next 15 to 20 minutes or so is just a brief overview of the research itself, touching very briefly on the theoretical context, some of the backgrounds towards lifelong learning, barriers to participation, benefits of participation, and then really getting into what we mean by catalysts and triggers in lifelong learning. And then I'd like to talk about the method very briefly, and then the preliminary findings, emphasising that the findings are very, very preliminary at this stage. I attended Dawn's presentation yesterday, which was absolutely fantastic. Dawn in the back row there, I really enjoyed it. Dawn's about to submit her PhD, I think within a month's time, and I was very struck by the calibre of your findings, so I realise I've got quite a long way to travel, but I'm hoping for some useful feedback today. I'd hope to talk for no more than 15 to 20 minutes, and really use those last 10 to 15 minutes for a discussion, if that's all right. So, without further ado, the research project itself is really exploring engagement in adult education, exploring those points at which retainers engage with educational opportunities as adults, and I'm looking at the environmental and maturational forces that are underpinning that decision to return to education. It utilises the semi-structured interview, also a critical incident technique, to reveal the specific influences and the stimulants that prompt engagement or re-engagement. And I'll come on to the method a little bit later on. And this third point here about exploring engagement across different learning trajectories, that's perhaps a bit more aspirational. I would hope that this time next year I might be able to pass more comments on that. So in terms of lifelong learning, I realise I'm in an environment in which everybody here is quite conversant, I suppose, in the context of lifelong learning. So I don't want to dwell too much on some of this underpinning theory. But I'm working from the basis that you've got this tripartite model of learning, the formal, the non-formal, and the informal. The focus for the data that's being collected has very much been on formal education, but that's not in any way to belittle or indicate that the informal or the non-formal is any less important or imperative in the context of lifelong learning. Acknowledging McGivney's early 90s work on the different classifications of lifelong learning or adult education being work-enabling, work-focused, leisure-related, community-related, and so on. So I think it's just helpful to classify those different typologies. And also acknowledging the potentially dualistic perspective of adult education, where you've got these two potentially competing imperatives, the workforce development agenda, upskilling the workforce, as opposed to the more liberal ideals underpinning emancipation and the emancipatory potential of engagement with adult education. So that's sort of in the back of my mind as I engage with the work. Benefits of participation, I realise I'm preaching to the converted, this won't come as a surprise to anyone. I think it's very interesting in Schuller and Watson's introduction to the inquiry into the future of lifelong learning, where they talk about the right to learn being a basic fundamental human right. Obviously there are benefits associated with health, well-being, civic engagement, democratic tolerance and participation, and so on. The flip side of that then really relates to barriers, actually. I think acknowledging the benefits of participation help to strengthen the rationale for the importance of looking at engagement and how we can support engagement in the context of adult education. But acknowledging on the flip side there are barriers to participation. I've got the model here of situational barriers, institutional barriers which can be negotiated with perhaps flexibility, or on the flip side, inflexibility in institutional policies and procedures, and then also dispositional barriers. I would say that in the context of this research, it's the situational and also the dispositional in the context of a learner that's perhaps of most relevance to the study. So, moving on. Motivation for engaging. A lot of research has been undertaken in the area of motivation. For example, Naomi Sargent's work in 1997 talked about categories to do with work, personal development, and also progression as being associated with different types of motivation. Moving on, you've also got this construction of expressive as opposed to instrumental motivation. The expressive being associated with personal development and the instrumental being more associated with skills training. So getting back to that economic workforce development imperative again. So just a brief discussion of motivation for older learners. I should add that the study that I was undertaking when I first registered for my PhD, the focus was actually on older learners. I've now rather left that by the wayside, not to indicate that that's not an important area for research, but in terms of how the sample has emerged, actually it doesn't focus especially on older learners. But I still think it's quite important to acknowledge that in the 1970s and 80s there was evidence to suggest that reasons for engagement were associated perhaps with more of those liberal ideals, the notion of cognitive interest, a desire to learn, some of those liberal ideals that underpin further engagement. But increasingly, there's evidence to suggest that older learners are citing more instrumental reasons for engaging with adult education, be it career development, skills training, career progression, and so on. So that's a little bit of information about motivation. And this is where it gets slightly less clean, perhaps, and entering slightly more uncharted territory. This idea of going from motivation to catalyst and triggers, and I will come on in a minute to what I mean by catalyst and triggers, and I welcome your views on how you would interpret that. So it's been argued that people are encountering increasingly turbulent, challenging sort of life courses that are increasingly unpredictable. And the term trigger first appears at this point. Jarvis was talking about it in 2004. This notion of crises in the lifespan, which can be associated with a re-engagement or an entrance back into some form of education, be it informal, non-formal, or formal. And some examples of this can include divorce, retirement, your children leaving home, or more fundamental questions about the self and identity, questions of who am I, where am I going, and possibly even why am I here. And I've just put in bracket, yeah, not here.
Question we often ask.
Yeah, indeed. And then I've just put that last point in brackets, actually, this notion of conflict and crises. They appear really in the lifespan development theory literature, the work of Eric Erickson, Levinson, all sorts of literature that talks about the stages of man as we develop as human beings, as we get older, as we grow older. So quite a lot of the literature for this PhD is grounded in lifespan development literature, but I won't dwell on that now. So what do we mean by catalysts? Well, it's a term used in educational literature to symbolise the stimulation of learning. You talk about, for example, a computer lab being a catalyst for learning. But it's not a term that's used specifically in the context of lifelong learning. I borrowed the definition from the natural sciences, where in chemistry you've got a chemical that can bring about some, or can precipitate a reaction. And it's this idea of a reaction in change that underpins this work now. And this is where I get into the slightly nebulous, slightly confused, if I'm honest, area. A range of forces and influences might be termed catalysts or educational. And then what do we mean by triggers? I feel slightly more comfortable talking about that, first of all, because you can borrow a definition from the dictionary, which I think is quite straightforward in a way. It's this idea of an event that is the cause of a particular action, process, or a situation. It represents a particular experience that is potentially prompted engagement with adult education, maybe thinking back to this idea of divorce, retirement, redundancy, for example. And it is a term that has been used by some researchers in the field. And that makes me feel perhaps a little bit more confident because I'm drawing on some literature already. Aslani and Brickell in the 1980s talked about this as just one example. So catalysts and triggers. I would add that I inherited these terms. I'm actually doing a funded PhD at the University of Glamorgan, and I was told that my study was going to be about catalysts and triggers and lifelong learning. So I've learned to love and hate these terms, and I still feel, even in the second year of my PhD, that I'm not entirely sure quite where they fit. But I've come up with these suggestions that catalysts and triggers, forgive me for reading off the slide, pertain to environmental influences, circumstances, potentially maturational forces, and the crises that can be encountered across the lifespan. And together, these represent two interrelated processes that offer insight into the factors underpinning learner engagement in adult education and also decision-making processes. And I would acknowledge that decision-making processes is an area of literature. Again, I know Michael Osborne's published quite extensively in that area in decision-making for mature students. There's some furrowed brows there looking a bit, did you want me to clarify anything? Maturational forces?
Yeah, yeah.
That relates more to the context perhaps of the lifespan development theory. Maturation, as in when we mature and we get older and we go through different phases and stages of our lives, potentially going from obviously being in school, having children, getting married, as we mature as individuals. Does that make sense? Some of those forces as we age as individuals. So that was a bit of a whistle stop tour of motivation, catalysts and triggers, and what we conceive of catalysts and triggers in the context of this research. On hastily to the research methods then, it's a qualitative, explorative study, and thus far the sample consists of 31 access students who are currently enrolled at further education institutions in the local area. Access courses being courses that students that perhaps don't have traditional qualifications or left school without qualifications, they can undertake a one-year full-time access course to give them the opportunity to make an application to a higher education institution to study a degree program. So I've met with 31 access students, conducted semi-structured interviews, and also some focus groups with them as well. And in addition, I invited all 31 students to complete a critical life path with me. And I'll give an example at the end of the session of what one of these critical life paths looks like. In addition, the sample has been supplemented by 10 semi-structured interviews with tutors, potentially for some triangulation, but also just to unpick their own perceptions, and also 6 pilot student interviews as well to kind of get me into the field. So the preliminary findings, what I've got is this first slide that just highlights very briefly what some of those preliminary findings are, and then I've got 7 following slides that talk about 7 emerging themes. But I hasten to add they're very, very early emergent themes, and I'd really welcome your feedback on some of those, and also some advice on how to go forward. So, in essence, the research is striving to go beyond the question of why is somebody taking part, to why are they taking part now, why specifically now. It's very interesting thus far that some learners are able to articulate a very specific trigger, while for other learners it's sort of more of a gradual, a journey, an unpicking as to why they're doing the course now. I believe the person that asked the penultimate question in the session upstairs talks about their eureka moment at the conference, and the term engagement having a eureka moment for them. And I've actually got here this idea of a eureka moment versus the slow burn. And it's that idea that some of the 31 individuals have just been able to articulate so clearly and specifically a morning or an incident or a day when they decided, this is it, I need to come back now. And for others, it's less easy to articulate something specific because it's been more of a gradual process. There's been some resonance with triggers for developmental change. Hendren and Cloyd, the 2 authors that have talked in the context of lifespan development theory about some specific triggers that can encourage development or potentially re-engagement with education. And also going back to Aslanian's work in 1918 about transitions and triggering events for education. And something else that's emerged is the importance of giving something back and being a role model for one's children. And I will touch on these very briefly. I don't want to patronize anybody by reading out the quotes. There are 7 slides to follow with a number of quotes on them. And in purple underneath, I've just got a very brief interpretation of what I think are some of the snapshots or the highlights that have come out of the research. I think if you glance through those quotes there's an overwhelming negativity associated with compulsory education. I hated it. It was traumatic. It was terrible, some of the students have said. I had trouble with one particular subject, which was maths. This challenge to do with maths is something that occurred in quite a lot of the conversations that I had with the students, and that's then became a real barrier for them in terms of confidence and so on. So a lot of the descriptions of school was punctuated by negativity, multiple references to struggling with maths, and also difficulties with teachers. Teachers picking on me because I couldn't do it and they used to humiliate me in front of the other students. So some quite negative experiences. But on the other side, it was quite interesting to see that some students internalised their experience and said, well, actually, I was to blame. I didn't want to learn. I wasn't interested. I just went to school to socialise. And others that were perhaps laying the blame at others' doors. So it was quite an interesting dichotomy there and something that needs to be explored further. It's quite cursory at the moment. The second theme that I've picked up on is reflecting on earlier educational ambitions. This idea that I didn't want to go to university because I didn't see that it was an option for me. It was somewhere that I didn't perceive that I belonged. And what was particularly poignant is the third quote there. Somebody saying, if somebody had told me a few years ago that I would be going to university, I would have laughed in their face. And actually, this woman, by the end of our conversation, was saying that I want university so badly now. She said, if somebody told me that I can't go in the autumn, I don't think I could cope. So it's this complete sort of polar opposite in terms of her perception. So that was very interesting. And just the sense of positivity, really, and pride of being part of the course was very interesting, actually. This notion of confidence and self-esteem picks up on this notion of pride. And overcoming perceptions, really, of not being bright enough, not being able to go to university, and actually the acknowledgement that I can do it, I am able to do it. So those quotes there really just highlight the power of developing confidence, really. And then the fourth theme is this notion of generativity. The term generativity comes from the lifespan development literature. It was Eric Erickson when he was talking about his seventh stage of man. It's this idea of reaching middle to late adulthood, and we all have these conflicts that we need to overcome. And he discussed the concept of stagnation, which is where you stagnant, I suppose, don't develop and don't change, and the locus of control, you think about yourself before others, as opposed to this idea of generativity, which is associated with the concern for the next generation, the development of the future. And I think the first quote there is potentially synonymous with that, this idea of wanting to get up in the morning and to make a difference, having returned to this particular area which is associated with levels of deprivation, seeing that it needed to improve and actually feeling that he wanted to do something about that. So that was quite interesting. And also this idea of being a role model for one's children, demonstrating that through hard work you can achieve. The fifth one here is just this notion of peer support. I don't think it's going to come out as rocket science or particularly shocking, but this idea that the cohort identity that's emerged for these students and the fact that some of them were saying that if they hadn't been part of this particular group, if they hadn't bonded with this group, or if they'd been trying to do something on their own, they wouldn't have stuck the course, they wouldn't have been able to get through it. And the sixth, so this one and then one more to go, and then I'll be starting to wrap up and look for your feedback. This idea of immediacy, this notion, I've got to do it now, it's now or never, I can't wait till next year. And some of them were saying, I'm on the access course now, I'm due to start university in September, but if I can't go in September for whatever reason, I don't think I'll bother again. It's this idea that it's got to be now, now or never. And then the seventh one, really, which I think potentially where I get into slightly more gritty detail, this idea of catalysts and triggers coming through, and some specific triggers punctuating the journey. I think of these three quotations here. The first one pertains to someone having left their husband. And if I had left my husband, I absolutely couldn't have done this course. He wouldn't have supported me. I wouldn't have had the support that I needed. Even though it's harder now in terms of my circumstances, now is the time following that separation. Another one saying I should have said with my girlfriend, that was essentially the boot off the backside that I needed for that. And also the third person was particularly interesting in this context, a combination of a relationship breakdown, redundancy, and then saying actually the circumstances now have conspired to make it appropriate for me to do the access course. Again, it's now or never. But those were some of the 31 students who could articulate a really specific trigger for them. And then to say that some of the others, it was perhaps a little bit more nebulous in that context. So some could clearly articulate that event or change in circumstances. I mentioned before this critical incident technique. I didn't just have the 31 interviews, but also I engaged in this inviting the students to undertake a critical life path. So all 31 were given a piece of paper that said birth on one side, today on the other, and invited to note down really the key events that had impacted on their engagement or lack of engagement with education. So they, most of them wrote sort of ages across the top. For the majority, junior school was good, secondary school was bad, and then there were all sorts of events up and down in the middle. Obviously, for confidentiality reasons, I chose not to put any of the students' documents up here, but my husband, very kindly, did a life path for me, so it's not necessarily representative of my sample. However, he's just highlighted there, primary school, it was all great, didn't enjoy secondary school, and you note that you end up with this kind of mountain range, these peaks and troughs. And what was very interesting to note was that of the 31 students, the final bit, as they approached the access course, was always on the up, always on the high. So that was quite an interesting one to take on board. But I invited them to write down keywords, a description of the event, or to draw me a little picture, just so I could understand what those key events were before them. So in terms of the methodology, that's my interpretation of this critical incident technique. So that is supplementing the narrative that have come through the interviews and the focus group conversations. So I hope that will enhance the robustness of the data. So to conclude, I hope I'm doing okay for time. We've got about 10 minutes. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. So what I have identified is this marked distinction between learners who can articulate a specific trigger and those for whom it's been more of a slow burn. Next steps, using in vivo to analyse the transcripts in more detail and exploring the findings in a theoretical context. And the questions that I'm wrangling with at the moment, and I welcome any observations on or feedback, are this distinction between catalysts and triggers, and also the development of a conceptual framework. I have to say I'm struggling to draw some of the literature together. There's a lot of literature out there in some disparate areas, and it's knowing how to bring it forward. And before I forget, the last slide has my contact details, so if anyone has any following thoughts, I'd welcome those. So over to the floor, really. Thank you for your attention.
I've got a question, but I just wanted to say first, if you look for Beverly Skeggs.
Just started to look at her work, actually. Okay.
So she'll be really good, her work with women eating into education, and the idea of escaping from
I must say, I noticed a number of very interesting references in your presentation yesterday, so thank you for that. Okay, that notion of escaping, and I have just started to look at her work, but not in great detail.
And the thing was in that video, then I really like the idea of your critical life paths.
Okay.
So did your participants do those first and then they formed a basis?
No, actually, and I'd wondered about doing it that way, but the way it worked, actually, was I sat down with the learners at either in very small groups, one-on-one, or I think once I had seven of them all together, and I had a conversation first, and then invited them to do the critical life part at the end. And I don't know if that was the right way or the wrong way, because some of the things they wrote down on the critical life part hadn't been mentioned during the interview. And I suppose in an ideal world, I'd follow up with all of them and say, well, you've noted down these particular events during your life. I thought that by doing the critical life part at the end, into the conversation would have got the all creative juices flowing and encouraged them to think through their experiences, and then it would sort of be putting it down on paper at the end. But I wouldn't have said there was necessarily a lot of parallels between what they put on the paper and what they talked about in the conversation. So methodologically, I'm not sure if there is a bit of an issue there, but I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
And in an ideal world, it would be nice to go back, wouldn't it? Maybe that's something you can do in a post-op.
Yeah. That would be great.
I'm quite interested in your first question.
Yes.
Because actually that was what I wrote down during your presentation.
Okay.
Because I couldn't see that you had come to a definitive position on these two given words that you sort of received from Gary Saunders.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I suppose the question is, do you think that it is essential to distinguish between catalysts and triggers, or are they effectively interchangeable terms for the whole of what you've been talking about?
I think they're overarching umbrellas. I wouldn't have said they were necessarily completely interchangeable, because I think I can define a trigger as being something very, very specific happening. But I'm not sure that I describe a catalyst in the same terms. But maybe that's not a problem, because together they're sufficiently overarching and broad that you don't need to distinguish between the two. I don't know.
I go into that because you might find that actually you're getting hung up on trying to define a twin set of theories and the relationship between them, when actually you don't need to do that.
Okay, thank you.
I was going to ask, because I haven't seen the other words or phrase that I come across, because I'm looking at some things to do with social networks and influence, was critical incidences.
Okay.
And have you looked at the influence of individuals as well as events?
Okay. I suppose the question that I've asked you being quite broad, and I suppose I was really waiting for things to emerge, and I suppose it would include individuals.
Because it will. It might be like a cluster.
Yeah.
So in other words, it might not be a specific, and it might not be slow burning, but it might be a cluster of things, or cumulative.
Absolutely. I think that's something that's starting to emerge, that you've got that group of learners who've got something very specific that's impacted on them, and
that.
Absolutely. And the others, it's sort of more, is that slightly more gradual, and it could well be that sort of idea of clusters, the influence of a teacher, the influence of a colleague, having children, all sorts of things kind of amalgamated together. But that idea of critical incidences that gets away then from the catalyst introduces is useful thinking.
Sure, can I ask a question? One thing that's been concerning me significantly, and I think most universities in the last few months, is this going to 9,000 tuition fees. If there's something like a counter catalyst in my mind, we're going to have serious problems with access to students, and that's one of our big programs, again, why I'm so interested. So when you did your research, did any people mention that a bit of financial well-being made they could start thinking about HE, like they've had a redundancy package, or the children have, gone to university, who've got jobs, and they feel more comfortable in themselves now financially to make the sacrifice to university?
Absolutely. There's sort of two parts to that response, actually. Yes, a lot of respondents talked in the context of now being the right time. It was because children had left home, or because financially their husband was now in a stable full-time job and they were able to cut back their hours part-time. So for a lot of people, circumstances were right that they could actually afford to do it now, but there was certainly no element of great wealth or anything, and a lot of the students talked about the huge sacrifice financially in terms of engaging in the education. What extends from that, though, is that not one of the 31 students talked about the rise in tuition fees. I kind of hinted to it, but didn't want to make it too negative an element, but nobody said actually that fees are going to put me off. Several of them talked about starting in September prior to sort of rises and other things to get themselves in the system. But interestingly enough, despite some of the financial constraints that affected all of these students, not a single one said I'm going to be put off. They were all on this path in this journey, which is quite interesting in a way. But as you say, it's quite a crucial
thing to will they all be going into HE? This coming September.
Yes, so all 31 of them were looking to go in.
And we've noticed an increase in enrollment last year as well for access programs, because students were trying to get into September, which is why, in my mind, universities' applications are bumper up.
Yeah.
But what would be great, Sarah, when you finish the PhD, which I know you'll get, very clever, my chat with you last night as well, it'd be interesting to do some postdoctoral research in probably 3 years' time to see how the fees have affected access to students. Or even following up some of these that you need to meet. It'll be very interesting.
Do you think your work is going to uncover the sort of focus that we have as an organisation in FACE, which is the work of the institution in getting to people? So from the perspective of the people, to what extent do you think it's going to be a factor, the work of the outreach work that first sort of made them aware of
Well, that was one of the questions that I was asking the students, actually. How did you hear about the course?
Right.
What did you research it yourself proactively, or did somebody tell you about it? And I don't know if it's a damning indictment or not, but certainly all of these students, I think three of the 31 had met with some sort of career advisor or career counsellor through the local council. But other than that, it was word of mouth from, oh, my friend, somebody that lives down the street's done the course. I used to walk past the college every day, and finally I went in and I got a perspective.
Right.
So none of these students had been engaged through outreach work. However, that is not in any way meant to be a damning indictment, and I would hope that the findings from the research will, it could be too aspirational, but I hope they'll be able to shed some light in terms of engagement and how to think even further about outreach work and widening participation work and so on. But I think you're talking about a particular community set here, a community group who they're not on the doorstep of the university, and I'm not sure how much outreach work has actually extended to where they're currently residing. I think if you were looking in the context of London or Birmingham or wherever else, you might find a different approach to outreach. I don't know.
I mean, the University of Valleys has been outreaching for 10 years and sort of declaring itself expert in it. So your findings might well be of interest to the outreach movement itself.
There's a lot of them in Tredegar, for example, and Newport University have got a lot of outreach work going on there, which is absolutely fantastic. The University of Glamorgan, in partnership with Newport, has recently started the Yohobe University as a Heads of the Valleys initiative. It will be interesting to see the findings that emerge from that in a geographical context.
Yeah.
But, I was very struck again by some of your references yesterday. I realised that was sort of gender related, this idea of border crossing and sort of that detachment that one can potentially feel from one's family when you cross over. I think it is important, given that it is based in this particular geographic area, to have some sort of historical context. So yes, I think is the answer to that question. I think that's something that needs to set the scene, because it is quite unique in terms of some of the historical
And I think Fabian loved that. Like, she's not published it yet, but she's publishing it soon. She's just done work in Welsh Valleys areas and looked at these types of issues, the economic changes, and why men don't take certain jobs.
That's what Valerie Walker's
direct. Okay, that's
lovely.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah, no. Let somebody else ask, because I've asked a question already.
Hi, I'm Angela Scanlon from the University of Ulster. Interesting comments I'd like to make. It just seems to be an emerging thing, you know, through the different things I've been up to at this conference about the whole cohort identity, you know, some of the Midlands, some of the students make little comments, you know, about that they haven't had, you know, other contacts, and they're not going to have left. And yesterday, some of those McNair students were talking about, you know, that sort of link and how it helped them stay the course, so
yeah,
how to navigate their way through. And I suppose this is another. To do post-op work afterwards. It's lovely. It'll be really interesting to find out, you know, when those people make the transition into HE,
yes,
they have the same experiences, you know, do they quickly become part of that piece of work? Did they, you know, because, you know, we're from lifelong learning in Ulster, and that's some of the things that we're looking at very practical level, you know, when we increase the completion of the cohort identity, we're making a really dramatic impact on retention very early on.
That's really interesting.
And I think lots of people will be interested in reading about that, you know, at the university level and the FE level as well, for access, you know. But
that's brilliant, actually.
I don't mean that you seem nice and focused.
Oh, I don't know.
I do think it'd be really good to follow up on that later in the chance.
That's brilliant. And I think possibly a disadvantage, I guess in a PhD you can only do so much in a certain amount of time, but the idea of doing something longitudinal, because at the moment my 31 students were all fantastic and they were engaged and they were excited, but what is going to happen in September? I wish them all the very best, but are they going to get in? They're going to lose this cohort identity, and they're going to be finding themselves in a lecture theatre of 300 people, and will they stay the course? And my PhD can't comment on that, but to follow us up in this idea of continuing that cohort identity, or can students carry it through when they leave an access school into HE? Are there things that we can be doing, possibly in the context of face research or postdoc research, to help people stay the course when they've made that transition?
Sounds like an academic career in the making.
Actually, a job now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.